Before we begin, does the panel prefer that I stand throughout or take a seat off camera during counsel's argument? I've gotten different preferences.
During counsel's argument, you can feel free to be seated while counsel is making their argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And Mr. Burkholz, can you hear us okay?
Again.
All righty. We are now calling court file A231902, Angelia Brandt, appellant versus Garrett James Brandt, respondent. Counsel, welcome here today. Just to note, we are appearing today via Zoom. However, the rules of decorum that govern our courtroom in person also governs this hearing. I will ask that you please, before you begin your argument, state your name fully as we are recording this. That recording will be made available shortly after today's hearing. Each party will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, with the appellate having an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal. With that, Mr. Burkholz, I believe you are the appellate, so you can begin your argument when you are ready.
Thank you, may I please the court, counsel. This is Attorney Jacob Burkholz representing the appellant, Angelia Brandt. We come before the court on a dismissal on Rule 12 grounds of a complaint brought on her behalf against her former significant other, and so in which now there is a pending divorce. And so I don't think, you know, from a fact issue, we're here to really discuss the facts, other than we believe, the appellant believes, there's been significant and detailed pleadings, of which Minnesota law allows liberal pleadings. But ultimately, a motion to dismiss was filed by respondent, and the district court granted that motion to dismiss. And
counsel, it seems to me in reviewing your complaint that all of the claims relate to property, its value, who's entitled to it, how it should be divided, things like that. Is that accurate?
Generally speaking, I'm not.
And aren't those issues particularly within the purview of a court that's handling a marriage dissolution proceeding, as we have in this situation?
No.
Why not? I mean, I look at 518.58, which requires a district court to make a just and equitable division of marital property, and in fact authorizes the court to go further and divide or consider non-marital property. Why doesn't that cover all the issues that you are raising in this particular case?
I try to explain that in much more detail in my reply brief. There's significant and substantial challenges for any litigant, particularly what makes this case unique is that, doing rough math, that 1/8 of the entire relationship is marital, right? That only about 2 years are married, but they're together for 16-ish years. And so when we come in front of family court, the family court can really only decide what exists. And I think it probably comes from a practical perspective of that, well, what will happen? And that's what I did in my reply brief, which is what will happen when we'll have the trial, which I think is set for next month, and in front of the district court. And what will happen is, and this, it kind of, again, this is a Rule 12 situation, but you're really asking to kind of dive into the depths of why was this suit filed? Why does nearly every litigant just walk into district court and generally litigate every claim? And I understand the court's kind of question saying, well, isn't that what everybody else does? And we have pretty limited case law on this. So what will happen uniquely in this case is that, and what happened in the family court case, is that husband, respondent in this case, doesn't really want to provide any discovery whatsoever, or doesn't want to engage in the district court. I actually have a motion for discovery pending to continue to deal with this dilemma, and we'll see what Judge Jass does with it in the district court. But what the argument will be is, well, it's all my non-marital property and you can't have it. And so that is what will happen. And so we'll have a district court. We'll say, yes, I have to divide marital property, and that will be primarily the house, and then there's a retirement account and other personal property. So I have a lot of these commingling. What makes this unique is the parties are engaged. If we look at the facts, then there's no dispute, including in respondents' own brief, that they're essentially flipping property, ATVs, other things, and turning it into future assets. So what happens? Well, respondent has an exceptional, not unusual, but one party in a divorce is usually engaged in most of the financials. So what happens? All things get titled into his name. Is it out of convenience or not? But what will happen is the majority of the assets will be claimed as non-marital. And again, is that
Can I just clarify, what asset are we talking about? I mean, the 2013 per, well, no, the New Ulm home, I think the parties purchased together in 2007, but sold in 2013. Is that right?
Yes.
So there's no division of that. I understand that. But to the extent there was value in that property that the parties, you know, turned around and poured into the home they now have in Madison Lake. I mean, I'm trying to understand why the issues that your client rightly wants litigated about the value of that earlier property that the parties held together, whether it truly is marital or not marital, won't that be litigated in the dissolution case?
No, they weren't married at the time, but they were engaged in this joint venture, this entire contribution of whether working together, building up a property, gaining the equity, moving it into the next property. I have never had a district court in family court, district court, attempt to even allow any questions going back prior to the marriage about this. The district court will get cut off. And perhaps it's just wishful thinking that the district court will allow this entire conversation. I don't believe Judge Jass for a minute will allow any of this going back prior to the marriage. We'll get irrelevant, it's non-marital, Your Honor, and we'll be met with this brick wall of evidence. So it's a nice suggestion that the court will entertain and allow this to happen, but it won't.
Counsel, I have a question here because I might be missing this, but perhaps you can clarify for me. Given that it's non-marital property, fair amount of it is, are you suggesting the family court cannot hear evidence regarding non-marital property and consider that in its determinations?
It's not precluded, certainly. So the argument, and I think my reply brief does a much better job on this, but we're left with this standard. I would describe it as when we're talking about the non-marital property, that is, a variety of most of the, I think only the fish house is really marital, but the Can-Am, camper, bulk of the house, all these things that are non-marital, that they accumulated with really no dispute to the facts. We'll be left with this needle, really tiny sliver for the district court. Let's assume Your Honor's right, that the district court allows all the evidence in for the non-marital property. Then what? We'll be left with a standard that is nearly impossible to get any proceeds. There's no fair equity treatment. I understand that it's a possibility. I'll describe it as a 1 in 100 chance. So does the district court even allow it? Maybe. Does the court have the authority to? Yes, in its discretion. But how many times has this court dealt with an undue hardship claim? That's what the argument will be. We'll go into state district court and we'll say, well, here's your non-marital property. Now, I'm hopeful we can try and get a clear record of what that is and what those amounts are. We might not even be allowed to discuss amounts, but let's assume we can. Then what? Then we're going to say, if Angelia Brandt is entitled to anything, she has, I think those numerous factors. I don't know if there's 12 factors under the undue hardship. And the appellate court decisions have said only in the most egregious of cases. So if that were, which is the current state of the law, Ms. Brandt would only be titled to a discretionary amount of an extremely challenging standard of law. That's what is capable of happening in the district court, which Your Honor's right. It'll be presented, we'll present it, and we'll hope and pray that she is given a handout by the district court. I've litigated this and there's no rhyme or reason, no logic. I think I've had one case in my entire career where there was an undue hardship claim, and the district court judge McCarthy in Sibley County threw my client $10,000 with no rhyme or reason. And every other case, the district court doesn't even find it helpful, relevant, or allows it. And part of it is because, honestly, this is a unique fact pattern. And you have unique fact patterns where parties are usually together for a shorter period of time, and then they're married for a much longer period of time where the bulk of the assets are marital. And therefore, the litigants and the attorneys don't spend much time on undue hardship claims because it's a waste of time. But here we have the exact reverse fact pattern. The reverse fact pattern is seven eighths of the relationship is in a non-marital context. So is it possible? And what I'm asking this court is, does this court find it just, fair, and equitable that if a party is together, and expand this out, 95%, because right now we're at about 82.5% of the entirety of the relationship is non-marital and cohabiting. Now, if you even expand it to 99, the same argument and questions I'll get today is, well, you can just go to district court and claim and make all your claims there. Well, what standard would we be left with? Undue hardship in every context. And that is so unfair to any litigant. Not only will district courts, it'll allow litigants to do what they're doing now, which is I'm not going to provide discovery. And so they won't provide the discovery. They'll claim it's non-marital. And then they'll say, well, the title's in my name. And they flip the burden of proof to Ms. Brandt, which is happening right now. And the only thing they'll say is, well, show me a receipt from 2003. And if you don't have that receipt, I'm not even going to consider it. That's what will happen in the district court file, which is completely different than what's allowed in the civil court contribution joint venture arguments for cohabiting couples. And that's also true if they were married. You don't need receipts if you're married because there's a marital presumption of property. If we flip this around, is there a presumption of cohabitation? No. But excuse me, is there a presumption of contribution in a cohabiting environment? There isn't a statement of law to that effect, but the parties are on equal footing. The parties then say you each have equal preponderance of the evidence standards. Mr. Brandt can rebut it and say she didn't contribute, and Ms. Brandt can say, yes, I did contribute. And that is an equal 50-50 legal, both in terms of burden of production and the burden of persuasion. And that's all I'm trying to get.
Let me just follow up for a minute. So you're suggesting that when the non-marital property is of greater size than the marital property, that a litigant should have the right to remove the matter from family court to district court. Is that what I'm kind of hearing here?
I understand what I'm asking, yes. That you should be able to litigate those claims outside of family court.
And then I'm wondering what non-marital property is still in existence. I mean, again, we talk about the prior homes they lived in, and they're not owned. Well, one of them was never owned by the parties, but the other one was owned, purchased by, and sold by. So what is there for anyone to divide? I mean, it seems to me the better argument, or the argument you would have in family court, is that both parties have a non-marital interest, perhaps, in the current home because of the proceeds from the sale of their prior residence that they poured into this property. Why am I wrong about that?
Couple of things. There is a list we have, and obviously the problem, I got dismissed on a Rule 12, right? So I can't develop the record, Your Honor. I'm not sure if you want me to. I can tell you exactly from my marital file what is and still in existence. I'm not sure that's appropriate to expand the factual record, if that's what you're kind of asking, because we pled as much as we pled, and I know that there are a significant amount of assets. I can just tell you from what is in existence. Is it a lot? I mean, tens of thousands, not hundreds of thousands. We understand that, but we got dismissed on Rule 12. We couldn't even make a clear record of what was in existence and isn't. Until I can't add affidavits. That was one of the problems in the prior motion hearings. Is this a Rule 12 or is it a Rule 56? And then only on the day of the motion hearing does counsel say, well, it's a Rule 12, and kind of changes that. So I didn't want to come in and start submitting affidavits when we were proceeding on Rule 12. Now, to your point, answer your next point, Your Honor, which is what happens in district court. It is I would submit an impossible, I've never seen a district court make a statement that the parties each have an interest that's non-marital. All that's made from a fact-finding perspective in a district court, family court judge, is they simply say it's non-marital. And as I try to explain, they'll only say it's titled in husband's name, and I don't have a receipt to show that they flipped five vehicles and three fish houses to show that the Can-Am or the $20,000 Can-Am, which is titled in husband's name, that is somewhat Miss Brandt's, Angelia Brandt's. Does she have a claim to it? She'll say, we did all this work repairing, refurbishing, flipping all this property. And the judge will say, well, do you have your receipts? And she'll say, no, we did all this together for years. And then Mr. Brandt will testify, well, the Can-Am is titled in my name and it was bought, 1 month before you were married, and that's it. She gets nothing. And that, unfortunately, will be the conversation, because they'll just say you didn't meet your burden to prove, right? Because the argument then is, well, we met our burden of proof. And neither party has lots of great receipts. I understand that's not perfect, but that's what happens when you have a 16-year relationship and you're together for a long period of time. It's really, really hard to engage in essentially an audit of your entire life to prove these marital and non-marital claims, which is one of the challenges why I wanted to start a separate civil action, because the party's testimony is evidence. And that doesn't really work when you're dealing with non-marital property. You just get cut off at the knees for these undue hardship claims and non-marital property claims when the property ends up getting titled in one person's name. I see I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. And Mr. White, you can begin your argument when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Kenneth White, and I'm an attorney from Mankato, and I represent the respondents in this case. This case presents a couple of fundamental questions, the first of which is, what is the extent of the authority of a dissolution court? And can a party circumvent that authority by bringing a civil action at the same time that the district court has a dissolution action before it? And I would submit that the answer to that is no, this court cannot allow such a circumstance, because to do so would wreak havoc on the entire dissolution process.
Mr. White, I have a question. Why did the family court grant the request for removal?
Why did the family court grant what request, Your Honor?
The request to remove to district court. And that's how this all started.
Well, it all started with the with wife filing a civil lawsuit, claiming a variety of legal theories against her husband over property that is part of the dissolution.
Right, and then they moved the family court to remove itself, and it did.
Your Honor, The family court still has jurisdiction, and I think counsel has indicated that, in fact, it's set for trial next month.
Right. I understand, and it just seemed to me from reviewing the procedural posture that the family court would have continued to assert jurisdiction over the civil lawsuit and didn't do so.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the district court in the civil lawsuit effectively did that, because when the judge heard the Rule 12 motion, he granted it and said, expressly says in his order, in the district court order, go back to the family court and resolve these questions. That's where you belong. And so the district court, in dealing with the civil lawsuit, effectively did exactly that. So the parties are, as of today, back in dissolution court. And in doing some research on another matter, I've noted some of the language in the Pooley decision, P-O-O-L-E-Y, of the Minnesota Supreme Court at 979 Northwest 2nd, 867. and specifically at 874, where the court talks about the obligation of the dissolution court to marshal the assets of the parties and come to a conclusion about how to fairly and equitably distribute that.
Mr. White, how do you respond to the appellant's argument that, you know, look, that may be true, and we know that 518.58 gives the family court broad, equitable powers to fairly and equitably divide property. But here you have 7/8 of the relationship is going to be outside of the marriage and outside of 518.85. Why isn't this a unique case that would suggest a civil action is appropriate?
A handful of reasons, Your Honor. First of all, as the court has noted, the vast majority of the property that is in dispute has either been sold or currently exists and thus is subject for the district court to make a determination about whether it is marital or non-marital. But second and more importantly, let me back up one step. And so that's a tracing question and an equitable distribution question. And I cited in my brief the McDonald decision from this court about a year ago, in which this court laid out the various formulas that the district court is supposed to follow in making that equitable distribution where there are multiple marital and non-marital claims. That's exactly the circumstance that existed in McDonald. But beyond that, Your Honor, the second major point here is that this court has already answered the question in admittedly three unpublished opinions. The district court cites to one, and I provided the court with the descriptions of Otto and Tiedke, T-I-E-D-K-E, two decisions, unpublished decisions out of this court, where the court discussed what the what the dissolution court should do with claims of pre-existing assets and how to divide those and to deal with them, and basically went back to the anti-palimony statute and said, if the anti-palimony statute applies, then we're done. If the anti-palimony statute does not apply, which is the vast majority of cases in Minnesota now, given the narrow reading the Supreme Court has given to it, then you can, in fact, bring in those assets that exist and do exactly what the appellant is asking for this court to allow to happen in the non-marital, with the non-marital assets. That is, determine which one of those belongs to, or how they belong to the parties, and how to equitably divide them. And that's what's going to happen in the district court. Counsel makes much of tracing problems. Well, the tracing problems are going to exist wherever this matter is litigated. If this court allows this case to go forward, then the Madison Lake home is going to be litigated in district court. It's not going to be an automatic 50-50 division. It's going to be a division based on the equities that the court determines, because the majority of the claims here are equitable. It's going to be an equitable determination by the court about who contributed what, on what basis, and how to most fairly divide that asset, the Madison Lake home. That's exactly what the dissolution court is going to be called upon to do.
Even if we agree with you on that point, Mr. White, what do we make of the separate claims that appellant has advanced against her in-laws?
Well,
they wouldn't be handled in family court, would they?
No, Your Honor. But there are two huge problems with those separate claims. There's only one mention of the in-laws, Mr. Brandt's parents, in the complaint, and that's the contribution made to the Madison Avenue home. And there's a factual dispute about whether that $10,000 gift was to him or to the couple. That's something the family court, dissolution court, will decide and resolve and make an appropriate finding based on that. There is, however, no claim against the Brandt parents. There is nothing in any of the causes of action that mention them. They are not in the prayers for relief in any way. And I don't know what claim is supposed to be litigated in, given this complaint, what claim is supposed to be litigated? The $10,000 was, and again, we're in a Rule 12 setting, a gift to the couple. Unless the Brandt parents seek to recapture that gift, which would be a lawsuit brought by them against the couple, there's nothing to litigate involving the Brandt parents.
Well, but isn't there an allegation? I'm looking at allegation 14 in the complaint that avers it's believed that James and Mary Brandt received the benefit of plaintiff's efforts and labors at 606 Kendall, which I believe is the Marshall, Minnesota home. Is that enough? What cause of action? And I understand there's no specific prayer for relief tied to that, but isn't that enough to state a claim that they were unjustly enriched by her contributions to improving that Marshall, Minnesota home?
No, Your Honor. First of all, because if the Marshall, Minnesota home has been sold, which again, the complaint alleges, then that happened in 2013 or 2014. 2014. Statute of limitations for any claim has long expired here in 2024. So even if that is sufficient, it is barred on its face by the statute of limitation, and this court can rule in the alternative to eliminate that claim based on that theory, which the complaint in and of itself establishes. Second of all, Your Honor, the complaint does not in any way give any kind of indication of what sorts of benefits the Brandt parents were supposed to have received from the sale of the Marshall home. The amorphous claim that we provided benefit to them doesn't tell them anything. What kind of benefit did you supply? And without knowing that, the Brandt parents are fighting a ghost. There is nothing that they can do to respond to that complaint, that claim, because it's so amorphous that it doesn't state a claim that can be brought. Even assuming there was an associated legal theory, which there is not, set forth in the complaint, and even assuming there was a prayer for relief, which there is not. And so part of this is we've got this huge pleading problem, Your Honor, which remains unanswered and unresolved. I think it is significant also that if this court were to allow this kind of a cause of action, you end up in a situation where parties are racing to the proverbial courthouse. As soon as a dissolution action is brought, if someone thinks it's to their benefit to litigate it in district court, then off to the races you go, and now we have competing jurisdictional problems with one party in district court or seeking to be in district court, the other in dissolution court, where the Minnesota legislature has said the family law court deals with all the assets. And the case law that flows from it deals with all the assets and decides marital, non-marital, and an equitable distribution. And so the situation that you end up with here is which case gets tried first. If the dissolution case gets tried first, that's between the same parties. Res judicata or collateral estoppel, depending on which theory you end up with, applies. So there's nothing for the district court in the civil action to do anymore. On the flip side, if that proverbial race is won by the district court case, the civil action, then the family court is divested of jurisdiction, which takes away the express authority that the legislature has given it to deal with the marital assets. Neither of which is a result that this court can allow under existing Minnesota law or any reasonable extension of that law. I understand that counsel is concerned about the realities, but The reality is, if given the case law in Otto and Tiedtke and elsewhere, and McDonald, if a district court does not allow that kind of evidence in, then you can appeal the decision to this court and presumably prevail before this court, given that case law, and have the matter remanded. And once it's remanded, then the party who then the evidence gets admitted, and the district court gets to make those decisions. So I don't think you're in any kind of circumstance where the parade of horribles that appellant argues is going to exist. I see my time's almost up. If the panel has no more questions, I'll briefly conclude and be done. I don't see any, although Zoom is a little goofy. So, Your Honors, we would ask that this court affirm the district court determination, finding that this matter is properly handled in the family court, and that this cause of action, in fact, should not be recognized in Minnesota, or this attempt to avoid the family law courts should not be allowed in Minnesota. And that even if some or all of it were to be heard, that the statute of limitations and the failure of the pleadings are further bases upon which to affirm the district court judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Burkholz, you can begin your rebuttal when you are ready.
Thank you. A couple of points that I always like to, when I get the chance, agree with my opposing counsel. I agree with Mr. White that this is a case of equities. If the family court arena had a statute, 518.58, or had any statutory authority that said the district court has the authority to equitably divide non-marital claims, great. It doesn't exist. Mr. White's argument is to create a new statutory authority, reading unpublished decisions like Tiedtke and Otto, for the assertion that Minnesota's statutory framework should have a new clause, and that is, non-marital property should be equitably divided. That's what I heard Mr. White say. It doesn't exist. And because that doesn't exist, this lawsuit is appropriate. What does exist? And I point that out repeatedly. I, meaning Ms. Brandt, is forced to litigate an eye of a needle. That is the undue hardship claim under 518.58, the exception to the exception, which is only in the rarest of circumstances can the district court do that. And then my experienced opposing counsel says, good luck, Mr. Burkholz. Good luck, Ms. Brandt, in appealing that ruling from Judge Jass. She'll make all those rulings, not grant undue hardship, and then say, good luck on appeal. Maybe you can get it remanded if you're lucky. Under what theory? There won't be a theory of relief because there are no appropriate equitable theories or statute that says that can be divided. So what are we forced with? It would be a guaranteed affirmance if the district court says, oh, Mr. Garrett Brandt, respondent, all of that property is your non-marital property, and Angelia Brandt, you didn't prove your claims. And I'm not going to award undue hardship because it's a short marriage. Too bad. I think that's what will happen. All 7/8 of their relationship will be unlitigated, undocumented, and have no relief. Period. Ever. And is that really what Minnesota law stands for? That's why I filed the civil lawsuit, is because, and keep in mind, I'm sure you know this, but Garrett Brandt's father is Jim Brandt, the attorney. This case is getting exceptionally litigated. And we're getting roadblocks of intense roadblocks in the family court file. And I don't think that's in any dispute. And if you look at the transcripts, you'll see that by Ms. Woodgate asking for Jim Brandt's opinion in the motion hearings. What do you want to do? So now, Jim and Mary Brandt, I want to address that directly. They counterclaim a 10,000, they make counterclaims of their own. So they're not saying that this is inappropriate. They're saying we also did some things. Now, I will point out something that Judge Berkman, you wanted me to help clarify. In the family court file, we found out that they're making another $25,000 claim of contribution to Garrett Brandt prior to the marriage in 2018. I know that's not in the pleadings because that just came out in the family court file. What am I supposed to do? This is already being litigated in another matter other than to turn it into a Rule 56, which maybe I should have in retrospect or attempted to, but that's not the motion. The motion's Rule 12. Now we have a $10,000 claim by James and Mary Brandt and another $25,000 claim that they're going to come into district court. Now, riddle me this. Is there a statute of limitations claim for a third party in family court to assert that they own property, that they have a non-marital interest in family court? The answer is yes, and they can always make that claim. There is no statute of limitations. Why is that? Because grandma can come in and say, 20 years ago, I put money into the farm. I gave you a down payment. There's no statute of limitations because the divorce triggers the statute of limitations. That's when the issues come up. Same thing with here. We're not with the 6 years starts when the divorce starts. All the claims have been litigated within 6 years. That's when the parties separate, 2019 to present. Everything is litigated within the 6 years. This is a complete red herring on the statute of limitations. So what happens? James and Mary Brandt then say in the family court, we made these contributions. Then what happens? The district court does not award that money to them. They simply say, that is Mr. Garrett Brandt's, because they will come in and say, we gifted the money to our son with certainty from the pleadings and otherwise. And when they say that, there is no third-party adjudication, as you rightfully pointed out, Judge Bjorkman. They will make those claims in our third-party case. And yes, those are equitable third-party offset claims. Now, the interesting part will be when James and Mary Brandt say, we gave the parties $35,000 during their relationship. That is an equitable offset that will be considered and not a non-marital property claim that will simply be awarded to Garrett Brandt in the family court and saying, well, your parents must have gifted it to you and we're stuck in gift law. We're stuck within that little narrow framework. I see I'm out of time.
All right. Thank you, counsel. This matter is submitted. We will issue an order within the statutory time frame. Thank you both. With that, that does conclude the hearing, and you can all log off.
Thank you.